You ever heard that? They'll go through. I've never heard a preacher from the King James Bible who could preach for very long, who used very much of the Bible, and he did not have to update the English. I did it myself for years. I preached for years from the King James Bible, and I changed because after I preached for a few years, the church was growing. The reason I did it originally because most of the people, when I first started preaching, had been raised in the King James Bible, and they knew what all those strange words meant, those strange English words. You understand? If you're raised with it, you know that a husbandman means farmer and so forth. Well, but I tried to preach for a while. I had a lot of new people in the church, younger people, the majority of whom either had not been raised with any Bible or with, not with the King James, and they didn't know what these words meant. And so I was spending all of my time translating the English into translating the ancient English into modern English. So that's when I went to the New American Standard. Because I'll have to do it anyway. But you see what I'm saying? It is ludicrous for a preacher to, in the name of God, say, you know, how dare we tamper with the King James? But then when they preach, they update it themselves. What they're saying is, we cannot accept a translation by a board of scholars who updates the English, but I'll update it. You get my point? That is, if it's wrong for a modern translation to update it, how can it be right for them to update it? Because they're preaching from it, which they have to do. It's on my nerves. So understand the King James, as translations go, given their manuscripts, and as translations go into the English of the day, it was an excellent translation. And even today, even with the problem, of course, you know that there's a newer King James, and they revise it 2 or 3 times a modern, not the modern King James. They're trying to do this, keep the King James. Well, by the way, often here it said, well, it's obviously God's translation, but it's had more influence than any other translation. That's false. The Vulgate has had more influence than any other translation. It's been the most influential English translation. And the real value of the King James, I may have said this before, I won't say this, but one of the good things about the King James, it was a poetic translation. It was translated with a view to being memorized. It is the most easily memorized. If you don't memorize scripture, memorize King James. Save yourself a lot of pain. And it was designed to be memorized, worded that way. Right? The King James, they made a beautiful translation. Under the reign of James, I point out at the bottom of page 74, there was tremendous growth of the separatists and the Puritans. Why? Well, they were preaching and making their cause, making their case. The Puritans grew as a political force. Keep in mind, Puritans are members of the Church of England. Separatists are yes and no. They're forming separate groups. They stood for democracy in the state as well as in the church. They opposed the Stuart monarchs because the Stuarts wanted the church to be more Catholic than the Puritans wanted it to be, and they wanted the state to be more of a monarchy. The Puritans held for a more democratic state. So it was a struggle for political liberty as well. Look at the separatists. This is very informative, I think. But here we have the beginning of the Baptist church. Where did the Baptist church come from? I often ask that.
John the Baptist,
right. Before we move on, I heard that you have this fellow named John Rawlins, first Independent Baptist Church in Ohio. He used to refer to Peter, James, and John, those good old Baptist preachers. There's a little bit of anachronistic there. 1607, a separatist congregation in Gainsborough migrated to Holland to escape persecution. Keep in mind, before the Bill of Rights, 1689. So, they fled to Holland. To avoid persecution. We'll talk more about that persecution later. These separatists came under the influence of the Anabaptists who had fled to Holland from Germany. And they accepted some of their ideas. Their leader became converted to the Mennonites. The main body didn't. He was excommunicated by the main body. But they did, this congregation, understand, of English separatists, did accept some Anabaptist ideas. They began to rebaptize believers. They rejected infant baptism. They practiced it by, they practiced, by the way, originally pouring, not immersion, that came later. They adopted the Arminian view of theology, free will, after regeneration. In 1611 and 12, Thomas Helways, that's pronounced, led a small group of them back to England, formed the first Baptist church on English soil. Got that? They were Arminian, free will. They adopted some Baptist views, adult baptism, and the Baptist church. And since they adopted the Arminian view, which says that all men can be saved, they were called General Baptists, a distinct organization. So this is the beginning of what we're called the General Baptists, okay? General meaning salvation is offered to everyone in general, as opposed to limited atonement. Did y'all get that? Remember we studied Arminianism? It was in college, and they got it, okay. Another separatist congregation, including among its leaders, Brewster, Bradford, and Robinson, who became the famous Pilgrim Fathers of New England, meeting in American history. They also migrated to Holland, where they came under these influences. In 1616, a portion of this congregation returned to England when things got better and established the first congregational church in England. The sailed to New England and established the Plymouth Colony in the New World. This was the beginning of the Congregational Church in America. In 1638, a group split from the Congregationalists in England and formed a Baptist church. They were more, took one of the Anabaptist ideas. They were more Calvinist. They retained traditional Calvinist theology and came to be known as the Particular Baptists. Why? Because Jesus did not die for everyone in general, he died only for the elect, the particular ones. This group, in 1640, accepted immersion as the mode of baptism. Yes.
What was their reason for baptism at this point?
But to demonstrate salvation. Infused grace, an outward expression of infused grace. Remember we talked last quarter, the very important concept, back with Tertullian. Grace as an infused moral force. There's evidence that grace has been infused. That's why we have some of our men today using that phrase, outward expression. They say, well, I'll agree that baptism is an outward expression of an inward grace. But you have to be baptized to be saved. They don't really understand the history of that phrase, inward grace. It's not biblical. The Bible doesn't say that. Understand, in other words, the Bible said baptism is a symbol of inward grace. I object to that phrase, inward grace, because I know what it means. I think you ought to object to it also, because you believe in infused grace. Grace is an infused moral force, which is the basis of Roman Catholic sacramentalism. We've studied that a number of times. I can remember a Muslim boy. You can still see churches. Still, in some rural areas, you will find churches using those phrases, particular Baptist. You don't see that much anymore. You see general Baptist. Often you will see free will Baptist, this Armenian strain. Well, James, this is when the Baptist church began. James tried to replace, remember he was the king of Scotland still had the Presbyterian state church, a Presbyterian form of state church, and he tried to change that for the reasons I've given. He wanted to deal with the bishop, not a presbytery or a synod. And so he simply appointed certain bishops. They were called Tolkien bishops. And the reason they were called Tolkien bishops is that nobody paid attention to them. Now, you know what a Tolkien was? You asked me, what is a toucan?
What's a toucan?
Funny you should ask. A toucan, in Scotland, when a cow has a calf, what you do is you let the cow go dry. A few weeks before she has a calf, she has good milk. And we let a cow go dry. She'll produce less and less and less until she goes dry. This is done naturally as a calf grows up, because a calf, as it gets bigger, begin to eat grass and other things, and require less and less milk. And gradually, the cow will go dry because her body can produce milk. Anyway, once the cow has the calf, they call this the coming, she comes fresh, is called, like our cow came fresh. And she has plenty of milk, but if the calf dies, a cow will often go dry very quickly. You know, if there's a calf. And of course, what you do usually on the farm, you would share the milk. Most cows produce, good dairy cows produce much more milk than the calf can drink. So you get the calf one side and you take the other. I've had milk many a cow. I've got a number of times. How many times with a calf on the other side? Yeah. And so if you got this calf around, understand? If the calf is around the mother, she'll get more milk. But if the calf dies, what do you do? See, you lose the milk. The cow will not get as much milk. The calf dies. And sometimes they'll dry up altogether. So what they would do is they would take the calf skin, they would skin the calf that died, and they would stuff it with straw and leave it in the stall with the mother. She would think that was her calf smell instead of the smell of her calf. And so the cow's not being very bright. The stuffed calf in the stall with the mother was called a toucan. Now, what was it? So these toucan bishops, as soon as the king in Scotland, as soon as King James appointed all these bishops over the Scottish state church, the people called them toucans. What's the significance of toucan?
Bishops over there.
Yeah, they were like these stuffed calves. They were not alive, not a real calf. And so the people called them toucans. They were not, they didn't pay attention to them. That's interesting, isn't it? I know some toucan Christians. I know some toucan preachers.
Oh, that one.
Well, in the reign of James, there was a setting of the Scots-Irish, sometimes it's called Scotch-Irish, in Ireland. What happened was, and I put this in because it helps us understand modern Irish history. Before her death, Elizabeth had, remember there was a Catholic rebellion against Elizabeth? Well, Northern Ireland was strongly Roman Catholic. So before her death, she had confiscated the lands of some powerful Roman Catholic nobles and given them to Protestants to put down the Catholic influence. And so, because Northern Ireland was a hotbed of Roman Catholic opposition, to further hold down rebellion, he opened these lands. Scots, why don't you go over? And he, so in effect, gave them this land because he wanted to dilute the Catholic, the influence. There was trouble there. Although he himself was Catholic, he did not want. He did not. He was more Catholic. No, he wasn't Catholic. He didn't want the Church of England to become Roman Catholic.
He wanted to be more Catholic than the Puritans wanted it. But he didn't want a Roman Catholic rebellion. So, over these lands, these Scotsmen came down by the hundreds and took up residence in Northern Ireland. Belfast was the capital. You got that? Elizabeth had confiscated the land. James opened it to the end. Can anybody tell me the name of somebody, of any particular of these Scotsmen who moved down into Northern Ireland? Scotland now. What happened was, look at this paragraph. These immigrants moved into Ulster. They're known as Scots-Irish. They're not Irish at all. You got that? They're Scottish. They were Irish. Among whom the Irish were the disenfranchised. They remained on the land, and there was a great deal of bitterness between the Catholics and the Protestants. And this bitterness goes on today. The war that they're fighting in Northern Ireland is not a religious war at all. It has nothing to do with religion. It is a political war called Protestantism, which versus Catholic, but it's not religious. And it's over political hegemony. It goes all the way back to this period. And it's not going to be easily settled. You got fourth and fifth generation people that fight in the same war. And what it was, originally a majority, not a minority, the Catholics who were disenfranchised, that is, in their own, how would you feel about it? Now again, I'm not trying to defend them, but how would you feel about it if people from, if you were Irish, and the Scots, and the Scottish people, under the sanctioned by England, the United Kingdom, came in and took your land and took all the political power. So outsiders, and the Irish were always very clannish themselves, so outsiders had all the political power.
Early 19th century.
Okay. But that's when it all started. Charles, after James becomes Charles the First. Hope y'all keep track of this. We had Elizabeth, we had Henry, Edward, Elizabeth. He was the son of James the First, but he was not nearly as smart as his father. He forced conformity, but he did it with a heavy hand. And the Archbishop of Canterbury, who was the religious head of the state church, was his henchman, the infamous William Lowe, called Charles Evil Genius. He did what Charles, who was not too bright, did what the Archbishop of Canterbury said, and the Archbishop of Canterbury wanted the church to be more Catholic. He was an absolute monarch. He ruled from 1629 to 1640 without parliament. We did not call the lords together into parliament, the nobility. They could not understand, they could not come together unless he called them. And he simply didn't call them. He ran the country. He finally ran out of money. There was this rebellion up in Scotland against him, and he had to have money to fight it, and he could not get money. Why? Because the nobles had the money. They had the land. Got money only from them. What was his policy in regard to religion? Lowe was Anglo-Catholic. Look back at our chart here. He was way over. Where's Anglo-Catholic? You see that? Page 73, way over to the right, the opposite of Separatists or Puritans. Okay, and he openly opposed Calvinism as much as he did the Pope. Got that? He hated the Puritans. He took the position that Protestant churches were not churches at all. By that he meant Lutheran and Calvinistic churches were not churches at all. These Baptist Congregationalist churches were not churches. So he really began to press them. He said that Rome was a branch of the true church. The Church of England was the true church. Interesting concept. The Geneva Bible was outlawed. That's heavy-handed, isn't it? You had to kneel in communion. Remember the Puritans objected to kneeling in communion? He enforced it. Obedience, he asserted divine right monarchy, rejected covenant theology. And he commanded, this is really funny, he commanded his famous Book of Sports to be read from the pulpit. Remember the Puritans, under their influence, the Church of England, under the influence of the Puritans, very powerful, said Sunday has to be spent in devotion and prayer, you can't play games. Well, in order to break the power of the Puritans, he declared that in every church on Sunday, 1618, they had to read his Book of Sports from the pulpit. And many of the clergymen of the Church of England, who were Puritan, wouldn't do it. You can see why. Look what it says. This is what happened. They had to read this. And as for our good people's lawful recreation, our pleasure, that is the king, like prevent in the old language meant come before. 1 Thessalonians, the dead, the living in Christ shall not prevent those who are asleep. Old King James means come before. Prevent meant come before, precede, let meant prevent. Now prevent means stop and all change meaning. Shall not let or discourage, let it or discourage from any lawful recreation, such as dancing, either men or women, archery for men, leaping, vaulting. Is that like Sunday afternoon? Football game? Or any other such harmless recreation, nor from having of May games. That was kind of pagan. You remember the May games? And Morris dances over regular community dances. And setting up of maypoles and other sports there with you. How would you like that? Where before the church, the clergy prevent, they'll sit on Sunday afternoon, after service, you cannot have a picnic, you cannot play games. From then on, he said, you're not to prevent the people from doing this. Well, the Puritan clergymen, obviously, who weren't going to read this, they suffered. Why? Because they were Calvinists, you see. They interpreted the Bible to teach Sabbath keeping. But is there anything wrong with doing it on Sunday? That depends. Think about it. do the Sabbath laws apply to this two Sunday? No, not biblically. Is it wrong to get out and play ball?
So what they do, he got him in, notice, he had to call him into session so he could get some money to put down the Scottish Rebellion. What were they rebelling over? This forced book of trying to change their state church, make it more Catholic. When they got, what they did, once they got in session, had their power, and the Parliament was called together, look what they did. They tried Lough for treason, had him beheaded. Think about it, the Archbishop of Canterbury tried him for treason. Charles' army was defeated. Parliament, under the command of Cromwell, one of the nobles, put the head of an army, beheaded Charles after he'd been impeached. So what they basically do, they tried Lough for treason, executed him, raised an army under the leadership of Cromwell, defeated Charles' troops,
impeached him, and beheaded him. Which wasn't exactly what he had in mind when he called the Parliament together. In Ireland, the Scots-Irish Presbyterians were worshiping in churches that were officially churches of England. They were under the authority of Bishop Usher, so remember 4004 B.C., we've got the date of that. When Charles tried to enforce conformity there, you can read that, I'm not going to go into that. Anyway, the point is that under the Long Parliament, Northern Ireland was rescued from Charles by beheading this Wentworth, who was trying to enforce this new religion, this new version of state religion. Well, anyway, what happened was, in the power vacuum created by the Parliament, the native Scots-Irish suddenly attacked the native Irish, attacked the Scots-Irish, stripped them of their clothing, drove them into the cold in the parish, and they, that is, under this. Protestants had been brought in, at least their eyes were torn out, the hands of little children were boiled before the eyes of their parents, women were stripped and ripped open, and then listen, the Protestants still remember this. The non-Catholic in Northern Ireland will still bring this up. It was one of the worst such episodes in history. In the years following 1641, over 100,000 Protestant men, women, and children died. Now, think about that. That is when the government, in this vacuum, the government couldn't protect them, couldn't send troops in, the Irish revolted in Northern Ireland. And they, what they did to the Protestants was horrible, and it created a tradition. So that, and as I say, it's one of the reasons why the problem today is impossible to settle. What the Catholics did was, so, well, you just read that. Cromwell, he was directed by Parliament, he was really the military leader of the nation now, under the authority of Parliament, sent a force to Ireland, made up primarily of Presbyterians from Scotland, and in the process of putting things in order, set up distinctly Presbyterian churches in Northern Ireland. Presbyterian Church in Ireland was first organized in 1642, and the Campbells were members of this church later on. This Presbyterian Church set up by Cromwell. Well, what was Parliament going to do? Well, the Assembly called, the Parliament called an Assembly in Westminster, 1643, 1658, the famous Westminster Assembly. It met at Westminster Abbey, with the purpose of settling the religious problem. You see, when Laud and Charles were taken to the block, Parliament did away with the Book of Common Prayer, which defined the remember Elizabeth's Book of Common Prayer? The second one under Edward, revised by Elizabeth. It was the standard of faith. It defined English. It defined the Church of England. Okay? When Charles and Laud were killed by the Parliament, they also got rid of this book. Now, listen to me. I know y'all getting tired. Listen to me. Their problem was they knew now what the state church wasn't. It wasn't that is defined by the Book of Common Prayer, but what was it? It's easy to say what it wasn't. So they called the bishops from all over the country to Westminster and leaders, not just clergymen, to settle the issue. The Assembly of Divines, to advise Parliament. 151 men, 120 of them were clergymen. And it was to reform the Church of England after the Presbyterian model. They liked what they had in Scotland. Presbyterian state church, not Episcopal. The Presbyterians dominated it, and they set up in England the basis of modern Presbyterian worship, and they drew up a confession of faith called the Westminster Confession of Faith, which still is today the official creed of the Presbyterian Church. And England became officially a Presbyterian church. You know that? For a little while, we're seeing it here. England, the the State Church of England was Presbyterian, the way it was in Scotland, where you didn't have bishops, you had synods, presbyteries and synods, and that kind of church government. Under Parliament, didn't have a king. And England was no longer a monarchy. Charles was not replaced, by the way. England became a commonwealth for a while. On page 78 now. If at the ratification by Parliament, 1648, of the Westminster Confession of Faith, you got that? That was the state. Westminster Confession of Faith defined not by the Book of Common Prayer, but by what? The Westminster Confession of Faith, drawn up at this gathering of Westminster to advise Parliament. Now, is the English State Church today Presbyterian? No. What happened? Well, it was Presbyterian for a little while. Didn't last very long. Why not? Well, I'll give you the reason here. Although the majority of Parliament, first of all, was Presbyterian, the majority of the English people were not. That is, the Puritan element was heavily Presbyterian early on, but later on it became more independent and congregational. That is, there was not enough, while the majority of Parliament wanted this Presbyterian form of church government, the majority of the people were either to the right or the left of that. That is, the majority of the people either wanted Episcopal or congregational. Understand? They didn't agree, but they didn't want Presbyterian. See, Presbyterian is now halfway between the Congregational and the Episcopal. Y'all see that? Am I talking to myself up here? So there was not enough, understand, we didn't all, on both sides, there were too few who wanted the church to be Presbyterian. Presbyterianism was highly intolerant. When they were able to legally make Presbyterian the state church, they had no intention of tolerating Anglicans than the Anglicans had of tolerating them. They set out to be very oppressive. I give you this statement by Samuel Rutherford. It's exclusive church. Salvation is not possible outside this church. Only no other assembly is permitted. And note this, the prevailing mood was toward comprehension. This is not comprehension. This is very exclusive. It became illegal, for instance, to affirm that a man has free will under threat of punishment. Well, that's not very comprehensive, is it? It's like the Roman Catholic Church. Oliver Cromwell, who had led the armies against Charles and put down their problem and solved the problem in Scotland, he was an independent Puritan, not a mainline Presbyterian. And lo and behold, here was the irony of it. The Parliament set up Presbyterianism as the state church, a Presbyterian state church. The leaders of it declared everybody else illegal, including Cromwell, who was the military power who made all this possible, who was head of the armies. He was, I understand that, he was not a mainline Presbyterian. So he found his own faith suppressed. It's hard to keep all this straight, I know, but I'm telling you why the Presbyterian not enough support for it. It was oppressive. Cromwell, the most powerful man in England, found himself on the outside looking in. So what did he do? He said, you got that? He wasn't going to have his ears cropped and his nose slit or anything of the sort. He simply, because he had the army, threw the Presbyterians out of the Parliament. That's what you guys going to oppress me? I'll show you. And he just simply drove them out, leaving what was called a rump Parliament. What's a rump Parliament? Not a voting majority left. And when this decimated Parliament got out of hand, he simply did away with that, declared himself Lord Protector, and this period is called the Commonwealth. That is, did they have a king? No. Was he born to the throne? No. But he note this. Charles, then when the Parliament tried to get rid of him, in effect, he got rid of the Parliament, declared himself the head of England, Lord Protector of England, not King, Lord Protector. And for a while, England was under Cromwell, the Commonwealth. Understand? Things were in a And but now what, since he was a Puritan, what was his policy toward non-Puritans? He tolerated everyone except Roman Catholics and Anglicans, that is Anglo-Catholics. He tolerated everybody but Roman Catholics and the extremely Catholic Anglicans on the right wing. During his day, the Puritans broke up into several groups. Now, this is the more important ones. You can look at that. I'm not going to go over that. The Levelers, these were the most largest, most important group. The Quakers came into being at this period. You know where the Quakers came from? George Fox. Bible became a divine revelation, but not the full and final divine revelation, very cultic. They had no designated ministers, they were simply, they did away with all the sacraments. That's what a mystic tends to do. Quakers, there's two groups today, by the way, that simply do away with baptism and the Lord's Supper, declare them to be spiritual, not physical. That's the Quakers and the Salvation Army. You know that? Salvation Army is listed in both the program and the Methodist, but under Booth. Booth is later on.
The Bible is not the only revelation. They had no ministers. All they would do is they get in the, they would go to church and sit on the men on one side, women on the other. And they would sit and the sermon of the day or the lesson of the day came from whoever the God was using that day, men or women. They would sit there with somebody beginning to shake, to quake, I mean. Indicating the Spirit was going to, had chosen them to be the minister for the day, and then they would get up and speak. They were pacifists, they were mystic. By the way, Richard Nixon was a Quaker, isn't that?
That's why I call him Quaker.
Yeah, because.
Here's what's happened. Let me sort of give you the big picture. This is very confusing, I know. You see that Elizabeth.